Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, big news! I'm going to be at Big Bad Con in Oakland, California from October 14th through the 16th. I'm going to be playing in lots of games and hopefully running a few with Games on Demand. I'm not going to be doing any panels or talks or anything, so if you're there, just come up and say hi. Huge thanks to Big Bad Con for their help bringing me out there. It's going to be really, really fun. My guest this episode is scholar and critic Catherine Cross. Catherine and I were both in the Industry Insider program at Gen Con, and we ended up in this really cool conversation about role-playing and identity formation, particularly in digital spaces. I'm so excited to get to continue some of that conversation with all of you. Let's jump right in. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on was to talk about role-playing in MMOs. I mean, I certainly thought for a long time that like, oh, MMOs are just about like fighting and stats and grinding, and people don't actually get into character and roleplay on those, do they? But it sounds like that was your exact experience.
Yes, very much so. I loved role-playing in an MMO. And in my case, I could not level a character without having a story for them, without having a sense of, okay, this is why they're level one, and this is their role in the world, and their ultimate goal is to do X, Y, and Z, right? I couldn't get a character to level 70 back in the day when that was the level cap of World of Warcraft and the Burning Crusade expansion. I couldn't do that unless I actually had a story that I was really excited about, really excited for the opportunity to tell with this character. And that was always what carried me over the finish line, because it gave me this sense of, well, here's why they're exploring the world. This is what they're seeing. This is how they're interpreting it. These are their goals. And this is how they're growing from the experience. So, like my Night Elf Priestess, for instance, I role-played her as a sort of internationalist Night Elf, like one who was bucking the latent xenophobia of Night Elf people and was eager to see the world. And that was why she was dispatched by the Temple, that they thought she would be a good ambassador for the Moon Temple and for Night Elfdom in general. So that structured so many of her interactions and gave me a lens through which she would see the world. And I really liked that. It was what drove me in these games.
And were there a lot of other people doing the same thing, or was a lot of this kind of in your head filling in the blanks, or were you interacting with other people? Was it there like an RP specific server or something like that?
Yes, there were in World of Warcraft and in Lord of the Rings Online and the Old Republic Online, a bunch of these sorts of places. There were RP specific servers. Of course, it was a common joke that although there were theoretically special rules for RP servers, mm-hmm. they were rarely, if ever, enforced by the people who ran the games. And so there would be lots of out-of-character conversation and plenty of unfun stuff happening, even bullying of role players. Mm-hmm. But there were, on RP servers, no shortage of people that you could play with. And so I was able to develop my character's lore in conjunction with a number of other players, some of whom I had memorable experiences with, and they made games like World of Warcraft that much more enjoyable. There were friendships and guilds and romances and all sorts of fun things that allowed me to have a forum in which my characters could be themselves and made it more fun than just, you know, it going on in my head, which that can satisfy me. I even do this to a limited extent with single player games where the only audience is myself. Yeah. But it was so much nicer to have that group context in which my character could be distinctive.
That amount of co-creation in a digital game is really interesting to me. Like, how closely did you stick to the fiction of the world? Were you developing just things about your character or things about the society that they lived in or the history of the place as well?
That's one of the things that I've always argued made MMOs run at cross purposes with role playing because it was impossible for your actions to be reflected materially in the game world, right? Except maybe by sheer luck, something your character wanted to do might actually have happened in a forthcoming expansion or what have you. But in general, like, the world was utterly insensate to your actions. And so some people created parallel lore. I was generally not part of that because I thought that it was a little less fun than finding creative ways of engaging with the limits of the setting. But that was a personal preference on my part. And so I wouldn't go too far from what was written. But here's the thing about World of Warcraft especially. Not that much is really set in stone with the lore. And Blizzard itself has proven to be as fast and loose as the most creative fan fiction writer with their own lore. And ultimately, I think that that can be a good thing. You know, the setting is a kitchen sink setting. It can mean all things to all people. And so that admits a wide variety of reasonable interpretations. For my part, where I did push the boundaries of what I was given was with, again, with my Night Elf, thinking very carefully about what worshipping Ilune would have actually looked like in practice. And what that did to social norms in Night Elf society. So I thought very critically about things like, would this particular society actually have developed taboos against homosexuality, for instance, or even things like polyamory? Does it make sense to have a one and only you happily ever after for 10,000 years when your lifespan is that long, right? So there were things that I sort of put on my sociologist hat and said, well, this society might have developed different norms to accommodate this this alternate reality in which they lived, which was determined partially by biological and geographic factors. Right. So that's what I played around with. But I always thought that it was reasonable, right? Like, I wasn't making myself a vampire or anything like that. And not that that's not cool, it just wasn't my thing. But that was how I toyed with it.
It sort of had to fit, or there had to be like a resonance with what existed. And again, you're the only judge of that resonance or dissonance, right?
In the end, yes, because it's not like anyone from Blizzard or Turbine or BioWare was going to come along and say, no, you're not respecting the law properly.
Right, right.
And I was fine with that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some role players got made fun of for their especially colorful interpretations of the world. But, you know, for me, in general, it wasn't a problem. I was happier if someone was role-playing, even if it was somewhat outlandish and self-aggrandizing, than if they were on a role-play server and just, you know, player-killing and leet-speaking their way across Durotar or something. Like, I'd rather somebody was doing something immersive with that environment.
I love that lack of self-consciousness in people, when people are able to just say, like, this is what I think is cool, and therefore this is how I'm going to engage with it. Was there a lot of negativity on roleplay servers? Did you have problems with harassment or things like that?
I did, yes, and I've written a bit about them. As I often say, I think that in a strange way, playing World of Warcraft taught me how to be a strong woman, because I found in that environment, before I transitioned, that I, who had been previously this rather mousy, supine person, suddenly in the person of this female character that I had created, felt much stronger, ennobled, and had something worth defending, which I did with vigor, whether it was in character or out of character, in chats, in game, or on the forums. And so I found that there was a crucible there that I actually grew in, which is not to say that like that the negative experiences were good or necessary or anything like that, yeah. But I made lemonade out of the lemons that were sometimes provided. And, you know, that harassment would take any number of forms. You know, you would get propositioned for erotic role playing if you weren't into it. You'd have male role players who would treat in-character romance as a suggestion of out-of-character romance, and there was cyber-stalking and the like. And so, you know, there was definitely a lot of unpleasantness. And as to anti-RP bullying, that happened too. And sometimes it was just plain amusing more than hurtful. Mm-hmm. But, like, there would sometimes be these quote-unquote raids from the PvP servers where a whole gang of them would roll up level ones and come into Stormwind wielding like offensive character names and start dancing around naked, for instance. And this was their way of like trolling us. And like, yeah, it was supposed to be like an attack, and sometimes the names were like overtly racist and awful things like that. But more often than not, I just laughed because it was just so silly and part of the WoW culture. And it was always fun trying to come up with RP explanations for why this was happening. So, like, we would talk about, like, you know, oh, the Miners Guild has had another drunken night at the tavern or something like that. Or something even more ludicrous, like a gnomish experiment gone awry. And it was fun. So, yeah, there was that aspect of it too.
Yeah. But I like that, you know, making lemons out of lemonade and seeing that as a creative challenge, or at least looking back on that and seeing it as personal growth, which is not the same as saying like, oh, that should be there or that is good, but just saying like, that's how I'm going to integrate that into my experience.
Because what other choice do you have, really? I mean, I could have dwelt on it, or I could have used it as an opportunity to grow and change myself. And the latter is what I did.
Yeah. In your article, The New Laboratory of Dreams, it sounds like role-playing and role-playing was a really, really important thing to you as a young person, and especially during transitioning. I wonder if how common an experience that is, you know, of young people getting to be this other person online and then kind of slowly discovering that they're perhaps more like that imagined character than they realized, or they start to inhabit more aspects of that.
In my experience, it has become a mark among a certain generation of trans people to have that as a practically universal experience. So many people I talk to, and trans men as well as trans women, or even some genderqueer people, many of whom I've met through the world of gaming, that they came to experience online role-playing of some sort, or even sometimes in different ways tabletop role-playing, as an opportunity to be a self that society was denying to them and that for various reasons they thought impossible to realize. So that is, it's fairly common, I find. When I've written about this, I often get emails and tweets and comments reminding me at great length that I'm not alone. And it's encouraging to see, certainly, because as awful and as difficult as gaming can be for people who are not white, straight men, it is heartening to me that there is this, as I described it in the subtitle of that paper you're citing, this culture of resistance that has emerged where people are using games in ways that were not strictly intended, but are still a credit to gaming as an experience.
Yeah, roleplay as resistance is a really, really appealing concept to me. And in that essay, you talk about roleplaying the way that some other feminists have talked about science fiction as this really powerful imagining of what could be, that is both like helpful and helps you explore something that you could be or that the world could be. A lot of sort of social justice work out of necessity has to be kind of reactive to the shit that's going on. But I like the idea of fantasy and science fiction and role-playing as an opportunity to figure out, okay, well, what do we actually want the world to look like? What would a world that didn't have all this terrible oppressive shit in it look like? And in role-playing, it's like, well, what would I look like? What would I look like if I wasn't afraid, or if I wasn't this or that, or whatever someone else had decided that I should be.
What I would look like if I wasn't afraid. That's a very, very apt way of putting it. And I think that that's part of the power of role-playing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the laboratory of dreams metaphor was something that I had borrowed from some old feminist scholarship on science fiction. And I thought that it was very useful because these genres are often, I think, wrongly maligned as child's play, and that sometimes even when we criticize the sexism and racism inherent to them, that sometimes entails a dismissal of these genres in and of themselves in ways that I think are counterproductive, because these stories are incredibly important. They shape not only how we see the present, but give us a way of imagining a different world altogether. There's a reason that these sorts of narrative explorations are basically sociological games where you kind of build your own society or build your own person in the midst of a specific social context that, even if it's influenced by the world you actually live in, is still a sui generis affair that requires some deliberate forethought, that you become this watchmaker of the universe, so to speak. And it's something that I rather like because it increases your awareness of the impact that all those moving parts can have on a human life if you open yourself up to it. There are plenty of ways to role play all your life and be completely dead to that deeper understanding. Mm-hmm. But if you do open yourself up to it, there is that way of understanding how societies come to be and how they can be changed through the simple act of putting the world under you as you make it in a role-playing game, because they are exercises in collaborative storytelling that specifically builds a world.
Right, which is like prototyping, right? Like a sociological or an anthropological or... maybe if it's just you and your character, a psychological prototype. Like, okay, what if I mock up something like this? What does that look like? Does it work? Can it hold weight? Can it hold water? Yeah. One of the other concepts you talk about in that essay is breaking down this kind of utopic, dystopic dichotomy that often comes up in science fiction, and I think is really easy to kind of fall into when you're doing collaborative world building. A lot of people ask me about or are interested in creating worlds that incorporate queer content or worlds that are specifically and deliberately queer in their games. And a lot of people seem to get really stuck in either, okay, well, we can create a dystopia where there's lots of homophobia and transphobia, and then we'll make characters to fight that, or we'll make this like shiny, beautiful, Star Trek-y kind of world where it doesn't exist. And like, how do you get away from the utopia dystopia thing? How do you consciously try to create something more complex and more useful?
So I think that part of it is realizing that, and I say this as someone who constantly jokes that we are now living in the cyberpunk dystopia. But reality is never one or the other. There are always spots of great beauty and shining achievement of the human spirit and sites of tremendous oppression. And the hope is that we can lessen and diminish the latter as time goes on. But a utopia implies a sort of finished state to humanity that I think cannot be reasonably achieved, and that we're the better for it, that we are inherently a flawed species, because that's what it means to be sapient. And I think that's entirely fine. And so going from that understanding to, well, how do I deal with queer people in my fantasy or sci-fi setting? Homophobia does not have to be, or transphobia, do not have to be the only challenges that we face, for one thing. And secondly, you can build a world where we exist in some form of inequality that is not necessarily, you know, related to gender or sexuality, right? So that's one possibility. I think that in terms of encouraging the breaking down of this particular dichotomy, what I want to see more of is recognizing that queer people can be villains, for one thing. I think that's a very important step that has to be taken, because I think that in either setting, whether it's the unalloyed utopia or the homo/transphobic dystopia, we are either angels or martyrs. And while that can theoretically be interesting, it's also being done to death. And I think that exploring queer people as human means exploring what is good and bad in us as people. Because society at large is only ever a reflection of the mass aggregate of socializing and sub-societies within it. And on the same token, we each contain utopic and dystopic tendencies within ourselves. So I think that not just whether you're talking about queer people, but whether you're talking about any character, if you want to place them in an interesting setting, then it should reflect the natural human conflict between good and evil that exists within us. And to see queer people as believable, interesting villains that are not like Saturday morning cartoon villains goes some way towards realizing that. I've talked about this rather extensively with women in general, that it's difficult to find good female villains who aren't like femme fatales, and the few examples that do exist often work so well as explorations of women's humanity in uncertain times. How does a woman respond to sexism? How does a woman respond to war? How does a woman respond to entering a new and uncertain society? So using gender as a lens for that can sometimes be quite fascinating and very useful, and should be something that's explored more than it sometimes is, especially in video gaming. I think that literary fiction in various genres, up to and including sci-fi, and I know that there are some people that will yell at me for conflating that with so-called literary fiction, but I think they're doing a better job of it than gaming is at the moment. But gaming is steadily getting better.
Absolutely. Well, we did a really, really fun panel at Gen Con about sexuality, sex and sexuality in gaming, which was super, super fun. But I'm really bummed out that I missed your, I forget the title of it. It was like Immoral Women and Why Your Game Needs Them. That sounded really interesting. Is that kind of the Coles Notes from that presentation, or was there other kind of important things that you touched on in that panel?
That's part of it, certainly. Yeah, and you got the title right. You know, I loved doing that talk. It was, I think, an improved version on a similar but longer and more meandering talk that I gave at GDC in March. And the point of it is to say that a good female villain has motivations that are seductive in something beyond the sexual sense, that she makes you want to agree with her, or at the very least you can see where she's coming from. So this is often the core of the ends justify the means kind of villain, the villain who may not believe that they are the villain of this story, right? That they believe that they're ultimately doing something right. And these characters are intensely fascinating, and it's rare territory for women to explore, for a player or a reader to be put inside the head of a woman who is engaged in those sorts of moral compromises. And that's not to say that if such a woman commits evil acts, say she should be pardoned, but there's tremendous value psychologically and sociologically in understanding where this sort of thing comes from, what might drive someone to make those sorts of moral compromises until suddenly they find themselves at the very end of that well-paved road of good intentions. And that is something that needs to be, I think, explored more fully. And there are some video games out there that do a fantastic job of this. The example I always go to is Knights of the Old Republic 2, because of Kreia, who is perhaps the sine qua non example of this immoral woman that I admire seeing in fiction. The type who makes you question, who holds you to account for your beliefs. Even when you know she's wrong, she forces you to do the math to demonstrate why, rather than simply falling back on platitudes and conventional wisdom, right? Because I think that morality has to be an active and generative exercise. It can't just be this static thing that you repair to with all of the weightiness of looking at a grocery list, right? It has to be something based on judgment. It has to be based on deep thought and analyzing your actions and the reasons for them, why you believe what you believe. And these characters, regardless of gender, can be useful for prompting that sort of moral examination. But it's especially important, I argued, to do so with women, because when they are placed in a specific social context that is inspired by our world, and interestingly, one of the prime examples of this I use is Lady Macbeth, right, from Shakespeare, that I argue in some ways she is actually, in Shakespearean terms, a tragic heroine, because she is a woman whose ambition was hemmed in by patriarchy, and so she had to act through her husband, who then loosed her control and became this murderous tyrant. And in a lot of significant senses, she was to blame for that. But her sin was no greater than that of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, whose hamartia was pride, right? It was hubris. It was the same thing, except Lady Macbeth told the story through the lens of a woman living in a society where she could not occupy the throne on her own, right? Where her ambition had to always be funneled through a man. And I thought that was fascinating. And it tells a specific story that I think goes further than any women's studies paper ever could in explaining what it's like to actually live in a sexist society and what the moral distortions such a thing can entail.
Right. Because, you know, I think the way that we paint villains says a lot about what we think about ourselves, honestly. Like, I think anyone who's ready to just say that this is the bad guy and they know that they're bad and they just love being bad and therefore they're bad. To me, that sounds like a way to distance oneself from one's own capability to do terrible, terrible things. And I think not acknowledging that capability is often the alibi that people then use to do terrible things. You know, you've written a lot about online harassment. And I wonder, you know, there is kind of a tendency to just say that, you know, these are just horrible trolls who are just monsters. And so they're just going to do this. And it kind of naturalizes harassment as just something that's just going to happen. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Oh, everything you were saying was spot on. And I mean, for one thing, this is part of the reason I think that we tell so many stories about the Second World War, whether through video games or through film, because the Nazis are the ultimate villainous evil, seemingly from another inhuman dimension. And we can feel good about hating them and feel good about seeing them die violently and horribly. And what that neglects is how Nazis were ordinary people that were persuaded. I don't want to say simply seduced, because even that diminishes a certain amount of agency, but were persuaded to go down this extremely dark path. These people were human, ergo we all have the capacity to do what they did. And I think that with all forms of villainy, as you rightly observe, there's this way in which we sort of slough it off on this kind of ontological evil, that you must be this sort of perfect monster in order to commit certain acts. And that's simply not true. With online harassment, I've argued against this from a number of different directions. For example, I've often challenged the myth of the 13-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that there aren't an alarming number of young teenagers engaged in online harassment. You know, cyberbullying is a major problem now in primary schools and high schools throughout the world. But to say that those are the only people capable of it is to ignore the very real fact that there are lots of successful people, successful by a variety of metrics that our society values, who have a job, who have a family, have kids of their own that have engaged in online harassment campaigns or online abuse, etc. And, you know, by ignoring that, we're ignoring what it is that moves such people to do those things. Because if you just say it's 13-year-old boys, the implication is, well, it's a lack of maturity. Right. That they'll just grow out of it. It's another problem that you don't have to do anything about. The world is going to keep on bending towards justice. They'll get older and they'll look back on it and laugh. And it's not that simple. I've also suggested many times that our popular narratives about online harassment as a political issue are sometimes a bit stilted. Yeah. The way that we talk about the online harassment of women, for instance, which is one of the signature feminist issues of our time, make no doubt, and I'm proud to have contributed to that conversation in a number of ways, but nevertheless ignores the fact sometimes, partially because of the lack of a properly intersectional perspective, that women can be online harassers too, can be part of the abuse, that the reality is that feminists sometimes engage in online harassment against each other or against people who are not feminists, right? And that there's a lot of internecine online hate on the political left. So to say that this is purely a phenomenon of, like, extreme right-wing 4chan types and Trump supporters and neo-Nazis and all the rest of it is very dangerous. Those groups manifest online harassment in very real, very specific and harmful ways that should be challenged and should be studied. But to assume that that's the totality of the problem lets a lot of people off the hook in a way that's going to ensure that this continues. And that's why I've written a lot about activist ethics. Why in so much of my writing, like even in my writing about Gamergate, I've pointed out that the nature of their collectivist toxicity is something that's mirrored by certain groups on the left, that they can get trapped in the same mindsets. And I don't even exonerate myself from this, right? I freely admit in many places that I failed in the past, and I sometimes continue to fail. None of us is perfect, but we have to be aware that of this potential in all of us to slip into those thought forms that then justify online abuse, online toxicity. I retain that capacity, I've stumbled, and so do we all. But the awareness is what's important.
Absolutely. And I wonder, what can we do about preventing harassment? Like, you know, a lot of the responses to it either have to do with, like, people protecting themselves, which is unfortunately really important, or there's this sort of afterthought kind of legalistic response of things. But, you know, a lot of people have said that either it's just something that's just inherent to the internet, which is ridiculous, or that is the just natural byproduct of anonymity, right? Anonymity was the huge scapegoat for online harassment for so long. And I think people are just starting to realize that that's not actually the key ingredient. How do you create an environment, or how do you prevent this sort of mob harassment from forming?
It's extremely difficult because the architecture of social media, which we now all take for granted and is woven deep into the stuff of our everyday lives, is something that was never designed with thwarting online harassment in mind. And so very half-hearted rear guard efforts to sort of change gears a little bit while the train is in motion, like it's obviously not helping very much, and it's difficult to do without changing the nature of how a platform like Twitter works. I mean, I think that with Twitter, for instance, one thing that can be done is give users much greater control over what they see. Right, like one of the reasons that Facebook can be a much more productive space for discussion is that it's easier to curate who sees what and how you can respond to it. So, like, for instance, I can delete comments that appear on a post that I make, for instance, because there's the architecture of Facebook is such that the post is deemed mine in the sense that a blog post is. I don't own it in the final analysis, but I have more control over it, that because I made the opening post, the thread is ultimately mine to control, and therefore I have curation powers over what flows out from that post and who gets to see it. Twitter doesn't do that, and it's much bigger than simply Twitter being a bumper sticker website, right? You can argue that that's part of the problem, and I have, that, you know, Twitter's short form encourages snappy insults and quick-witted nastiness over in-depth and reasoned discussion. Right. But I don't think that that's all of it. I've seen as much beauty in brief wit on that site as I've seen hatred. It's more a matter of the nastiness being allowed to run unchecked that causes it to propagate rather than the inherent nature of the medium. Because believe me, look, I posted on Reddit for years. I was moderator of the feminist website, The Border House. You can be really shitty in very long form. Some people have a lot of time on their hands. So it's not simply a matter of 140 characters, fashionable though it is in some sectors of the commentariat, to blame everything on that. I think that, in other words, Twitter just needs to give users more individual level control. In the larger fight, as you pointed out, and as I've also written and spoken about in a number of places, anonymity does not cause online harassment. That's a scapegoat, and to be quite frank, speaking of Facebook, it's a scapegoat that has been very profitable for that website, which depends ideologically on compelling users to reveal their driver's license identities, right? So we have to move away from thinking of that as a solution to the problem, because really it's just sort of pushing it around. Over the long term, more has to be done, I think, to actively moderate sites like Reddit. I criticized Reddit very strongly in the wake of Ellen Power stepping down because they had suggested that they were going to move towards a strategy of containment, right? That they would allow excruciatingly racist subreddits like Coontown and so forth and white nationalist subreddits to continue to exist because free speech, etc., etc., but that it would be okay because they'd be contained. But that's not how these groups operate. They use these fora as staging grounds to ratchet each other up and up and up like a low self-esteem engine to attack other people, using these fora as a staging ground to both justify the attack and provide the emotional gunpowder behind it. So that strategy isn't going to work. You have to actively decide, do I want to host this sort of material on my site or not? And so many people get caught up on the, oh, but who decides question, right? We all do. we all as a society come to collective decisions about what is considered acceptable and unacceptable. And it is not unseemly for a site like Reddit to take responsibility for what happens on its site as a result of these sorts of groups spiraling out of control. Because it's no longer just an issue about speech in the ether, it's about action. Mm-hmm. So avoiding containment is also a good idea, ultimately. I also think that after a fashion, we should be able to do something about data brokers, who are the people that provide the personal information of millions of people without their knowledge on the internet for either a small nominal fee or absolutely free. That it's an enormous problem that has to be dealt with in some capacity. And it remains a grey area in the law that these groups operate in. And people who dox and swat take advantage of that freely available information that they wouldn't have the skill to hunt down otherwise. And that taps into so many other areas too, such as abusive ex-partners and spouses tracking down their erstwhile companions and hurting them with the information they find. So those are three things that I think can be addressed.
You know, that last point about the availability of personal data, you've written before about how anonymity can actually be beneficial for some people. Anonymity can actually be a wonderful thing. Can you expand on that and talk about that? And maybe in the context of role-playing especially, what the ability to be anonymous online can actually do for people.
So I'm in the midst of working on this academic paper about digital citizenship, if you like. There's constructing a baseline set of theoretical ideas by which we can talk about what a broad, small-c Catholic citizenship means in the information age, when so many of us are participating in social activities online without the interference of national borders and things like that, a kind of global digital citizenship, if you like. And one of the core rights that I theorize about is the right to be anonymous, which I think for a variety of reasons that should be self-evident is core to how we can comport ourselves online and how we can be political actors on the internet. Certainly, people point to 4chan's anonymous culture and say that allows them to get away with murder, but I think that it allows just as many people to protect themselves. And also, as I've pointed out, anonymity is not simply the absence of a legal identity. It is a site of creation that allows you to create a new one, or new multiple identities. And that's something that has to be more carefully considered than it has been, because it's thought of as a binary state. Either you're putting your legal name out there or you're not, and there's nothing in its place. But the reality is that many people are out there known by usernames or handles, or sometimes just by avatars, and those folks are just as real and have reputations on the basis of those virtual identities and personalities, and can suffer consequences that accrue to them as a result, as well as gain fame and remuneration from them. And that's fascinating to me. People have used anonymity not just to erase identity markers, but to erect wholly new ones. And it should be our right to create them, because virtuality by its very nature affords us that ability. And it does so much good. As I said earlier, you know, so many trans people came to their identities in no small measure because we role-played them first. And that gave us a safe place to experiment with being another gender, which is a much riskier proposition for some people to do in the physical world. it remains still very dangerous, an experiment to carry out, especially if you live in certain places. But even those of us who grew up in, you know, so-called liberal cities, that wasn't something that I could have done in my childhood in New York safely, mm-hmm. right? So video gaming and virtuality afforded me that opportunity by being able to hide the identity markers that I was saddled mm-hmm. with at birth. I was able to then take a much more active role in authoring a new identity for myself that then eventually became my legal identity. Mm-hmm. You know, Catherine Cross is my real name in every sense of that mm-hmm. term. But anonymity and my right to it is what allowed me to do that, allowed me to be the author of myself. And I think that there's so much that comes out of that particular right existing as it does from political activism in countries where, you know, the authorities will lock you up for being associated with certain political movements. And frankly, that includes the United yeah. States. Like, you know, it's not just something that happens over there, right? That, you know, the US government, as some activists, particularly on the left, can tell you, is sometimes very overzealous in persecuting and prosecuting people with the wrong beliefs. And so online anonymity can be a great aid to that as well. It secures free speech in the meaningful sense, not in the, you know, hashtag free speech activist that you see in so many Twitter bios nowadays, which really means I just like to be a giant jackass online without any consequences. Right. But actual free speech that genuinely challenges the powerful. And it's I think a right to anonymity is essential to preserving the internet's capacity to hold the meaningfully powerful to account, not through online harassment, but through actual online organization and activism. You know, we've seen that with the Arab Spring, we've seen that with the color revolutions, we've seen that with Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter, for yeah. example. And the beauty of it, of virtuality, is that it is often a continuum between the physical world and the online world, which is why I always say, you know, I never use the phrase IRL, because it's all real, it's all meaningful. But like for Black Lives Matter, the internet is a staging area for education, for marshalling support, for supporting each other emotionally and spiritually, and for organising actual physical world protests and actions like sit-ins or occupations, etc. And I think that it demonstrates the tremendous value of having a space where one can speak anonymously or pseudonymously.
And it becomes difficult at a certain point to make a distinction between physical space occurrences and virtual occurrences. Like I remember during, like at the very start of the protests in Ferguson, watching like a live feed of that. And so I'm sitting in my bedroom at my computer in the middle of the night, but at the same time, that was not disconnected from the real world at all. That I think it's powerful. I'd love to talk more about identity formation, because I wonder, like, is there something to the formation of different identities to a plurality of identities online as well? And is that kind of the direction that humanity is kind of going, to have plural identities because they're different people in different places?
I think so. And I think that the online world facilitates this more than any other technology we've yet devised. I think because the reality of being human has always entailed multiple selves. We all are familiar with the phenomena of being at least somewhat different people in different social contexts. You're a different person at work than you are at home, than you might be at a party versus a different friend's party, say. And that's part of being who we are. It's why I say that there is no quote-unquote true self at rock bottom, just a rotating series of masks that when added together in aggregate make the whole person, right? Because not everyone uses the same sets of masks. And I think that that's a good thing to recognize. It's not about, you know, you being a faker, but it's about understanding what it means to be a social creature, that even the most willful among us adapt to the environments in which we happen to be acting in a given moment. And I think that the internet over the long term may amplify that tendency, may allow people to more fully explore who they are in given moments. I think that, you know, talking of romance, even polyamory does that to a certain extent. One of the things that I love about polyamory is that I feel like a different woman in different romantic relationships that I'm in, that allow me to explore different sides of my romantic and sexual personalities that may not find expression in other relationships. And they're all the same person and they're all authentic. Mm-hmm. So I think that polypersonhood, if you like, is something that is indeed coming down the pipeline, because it just seems like the natural progression of things as we spend more and more of our time online to start exploring those different forks of our identities. And that is all to the good so far as I'm concerned.
You know, that appeals to me as a LARPer. Like, you know, I think a lot of really deliberate role taking or really deliberate character work is often kind of just being more explicit about things that people are already kind of doing without acknowledging it or without doing it in a intentional way, right? Of deciding this is the person that I'm going to be for the duration of this interaction, rather than, like you say, just kind of figuring out what works in a given situation and kind of going with it. And then wondering, yeah, is there a core personhood and then some masks, or is it masks all the way down? Speaking of role-playing games, you're coming to Big Bad Con, right?
I absolutely am.
I'm
yes.
So excited. I just found out that I get to go to Big Bad Con. I'm stoked as hell.
Oh, wonderful. I look forward to seeing
you. Yeah, it'll be wonderful. It'll be really cool to hang out again. I wonder, what about, because I think you went last year, right?
I did,
And yes. What about that space made you think, like, yeah, I've got to come back here. I've got to do this again.
What I love about Big Bad Con is that it is a laboratory within a laboratory, basically. And yes, I pronounce it both ways because I'm weird like that. But I love that aspect of it because it's this incubator of new games where you are testing sometimes first drafts of role-playing games that are really good and really creative, but you know would have a hard time either finding space or attention at something huge like Gen Con. And here you've got a smaller, harder core of very engaged role-players who love the craft of RPG making and love these indie games that are ready, willing, and able to play and offer useful beta testing feedback, right? And I love this environment because it is so full of people who are just so very passionate about indie role-playing games in particular, that this is a place for showing off the things that are at the bleeding edge of the imagination in role-playing game design, which I think there isn't enough of right now. I went to Gen Con. I was a special guest there. I was very honored to be selected as an industry insider, and I had a fantastic time. I hope I get to go again next year. But there's something about that sort of massive convention environment where it's dominated by a few large key players that can sometimes crowd out these smaller things that may deserve a little attention and nurturing. And I found a lot of experiences at Big Bad Con last year that I know I wouldn't have gotten to access any other way. I'm thinking about games like Apilion, the wonderful cute dragon RPG based on Powered by the Apocalypse system. I'm thinking of Cartel, which was about basically role-playing a character in a Mexican drug cartel. And it's surprisingly sensitively done. It was not the sort of thing that Had I not been in this intimate environment with some people whose judgment I trust, I never would have given it a second glance, just thinking, oh, this is appropriative bullshit that's likely going to be, you know, stupidly offensive and bad all the way down. And instead, it turned out to be an absolutely fascinating and unsettling experience in the best way. And there was a lot of useful, intelligent discussion that came out of me playing that. Another great game I found was Fall of Magic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, aside from just being a beautiful set piece all on its own with a cloth map that is basically furled up as a scroll that you unfurl as you play, it was just this beautiful RPG experience that I got to engage in with people. And I was basically kind of I was just playing it for fun, but I was playing it in a test phase, so to speak. So I was actually able to give a certain amount of feedback on the game, most of which was just adulation. But I get the opportunity to do this with all of these interesting smaller titles that remind me of the best of the imaginative potential of role-playing gaming. What's not to love?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think adulation is support, right? And support is just as important as criticism when it comes to, you know, especially these games, which are so much a labor of love for so many people, you know, that they work on for years and years and years. And you're right, even if you're not making role-playing games, it's sometimes just extremely satisfying to get to be a part of the process or feel like you contributed to it existing and getting out there and being the best it can be.
Yes, absolutely. And it's what I love about Big Bad Con, that being a part of that world is possible. And, you know, it's small and it can take a minute to find your niche, and a lot of people there are friends with each other. So it was a kind of intimidating first-time experience because I don't have a huge expo hall to go and hide in, right? But I quickly found my footing and I go back now to meet friends old and new. Mm-hmm. Yourself included.
Yay, yeah. Happily. It's going to be totally awesome. That seems like a very nice note to end on. If my listeners want to keep up with what you're up to and what you're writing and publishing, where should they go?
So I have a more or less weekly column on Gama Sutra. That's at gamasutra.com, the art and business of making games. I write about gaming culture there and do game analyses and reviews roughly once a week. And you can follow my Twitter at Quinnae_moon. That's at Quinnae_moon on Twitter for just me blathering about politics, gaming, and occasionally linking to my latest work.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was totally awesome. Thanks again to Catherine for joining me, and as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you ever want to get in touch or have a question about the show, you can always reach me via email. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com. On Google+, that's backstorypodcast, or on Twitter at backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, Talking Tabletop, First Watch, and Second Watch, all at oneshotpodcast.com. The most recent Second Watch details pretty much everything I got up to at Gen Con, and it was super fun to record, so you should totally go check it out. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes!